We're going to call the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today, Chair Cornish is sick, so I'll be taking over his duties. Hopefully, things will go well. We will take a roll call.
Representative Cornish. Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Present.
Representative Lohmer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
It's just got to be different, doesn't it?
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
We do have a quorum. Has any member had an opportunity to review the minutes? Representative Considine, do you wish to?
I do.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes. And all those in favor? Any corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion. Any opposed? Motion approved. We're going to have a start with an overview from the Uniform Law Commission. If I believe it's Michelle Timmons, if you want to introduce yourself and get started.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you so much for having us today to give an overview of the Uniform Law Commission. I'm Michelle Timmons, former reviser of statutes, served in that capacity for 18 years. I retired on November 1st, but I also got an appointment to remain on as a Uniform Law Commissioner. So I'm here today with the reviser hat removed and the Uniform Law Commission hat on, and we'll be giving you an overview. I'd like to introduce a Uniform Law Commissioner who's here with me, Kimberly Lowe, and perhaps you could introduce yourself, Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, I'm Kim Lowe. I'm a lawyer. I practice in Minneapolis. I'm a transactional lawyer. I was recently appointed as Uniform Law Commissioner in 2016. I sort of hold the seat that is sort of delegated for the business law people or practitioners in the state. And so today we're gonna play a brief video for you. If technology works for us, that'll show you or tell you what the Uniform Law Commission is all about, and then we'll give you some details about our commission itself.
All right. So yes, we'll attempt to play the video featuring Sandra Day O'Connor.
It's a national organization, hundreds upon hundreds of volunteer attorneys, smart, capable, committed from different political persuasions, from diverse backgrounds and fields and geographic areas.
We attempt to draft well-crafted and well-conceived legislation
at the state level as opposed to having congressional action on specified subjects for which uniformity of law is considered to be beneficial.
To advance the general welfare of our country, the work of the Uniform Law Commission is absolutely critical to the success of our nation. A little more than 100 years after the founding fathers drafted the United States Constitution, 12 representatives from 7 states met in Saratoga Springs, New York,
to continue their work perfecting the Union and maintaining a healthy balance between the state and federal governments. The organization they formed that day came to be known as the Uniform Law Commission. Frederick Stimson, the commission's first secretary, wrote, "It is probably not too much to say
that this is the most important juristic work undertaken in the United States since the adoption of the federal Constitution." Wow. That's quite a statement, but there's much truth in that.
Fundamentally, it's a four-step process. We
the research and study whether there was a need for a law. Number two, we did our best to bring in lobby input and to draft the best law we can. Third, we bring it to the legislatures around the United States, educate them, answer their questions, and promote the enactment. And finally, we monitor after it's been enacted, how is it working, and if it needs to be revised, then we start the process again.
Years and years ago, before I was elected to the House of Representatives in Washington, I worked in the Illinois State Senate for 13 years. Time and again, the Uniform Law Commission would produce laws that were considered by the General Assembly, both the House and the Senate. Time and again, they passed, because we had confidence then, as we do now, that the work product we were given was the best.
The Uniform Law Commission and its Uniform Acts affects Americans in every possible way.
In our country, we don't take organs or tissues from deceased people. It's always something that the person has willed. And that whole structure, the whole idea that this is a gift, came out of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. It could have very well gone the other way. It could have very well been that we would have a market in a human kidney as if it were a medical device. The reason we didn't go that way was in the Royal Commissioners.
Before there was an Unclaimed Property Act, there were assets that went unclaimed.
Mostly money type of property. The upshot was that there was a windfall to businesses because there was no one to whom they had a turnover or account for the property.
Basically, under the Unclaimed Property Act, the holders of the property have to turn it over to the state.
That basically stays with the state until someone would come forward to claim it. The state has the use of that.
But in the time since the first version of the Unclaimed Property Act was enacted in our home state, which was sometime in the mid to late 60s, the transfer to the general fund has been in excess of $140 million. So if legislators have ever asked me whether I thought our state commission carries its own weight in terms of bringing revenue to the state, I have already answered. It's a pretty good return.
Well, the crown jewel of the Uniform Law Commission is the Uniform Commercial Code. It has been adopted in every jurisdiction, and it controls commercial activity in the United States. It was jointly developed with the American Law Institute.
Before the enactment of the code, I think it was more costly. There was less predictability, and business does not thrive on unpredictability. And the code breaking helped to empower owner.
Many businesses cross state lines and cross state borders and think how impossible it would be without uniform laws governing transportation and trade and commerce among the states. It's just inconceivable to us. We can't even imagine a nation without having those uniform laws. We expect them.
The whole banking industry is based upon the code. Checks, the transfers of billions of dollars every hour are being transferred. These are all controlled by the legislation that's come out of this conference.
The Uniform Commercial Code sets the parameters of business interaction in terms of sales, contracts, the effectiveness of language in commercial transactions. It is the backbone of American commerce.
Another statute which has become very important is the Collaborative Law Act. That act has been particularly critical in providing clients another alternative besides litigation or mediation or arbitration. It's a wonderful dispute resolution solution for them. The beautiful thing about the uniform statutes is it's not one interest group that has created the product. And they take 2-3 years to develop such a product. It's a wonderful collaborative effort of many interests, and that's why the statutes are so very important and useful.
Well, over time, it's been a dirty little secret of elections that it's just hard to get materials to people serving overseas and get them back in time for an election. So we were looking for a partner who could help us work in the States in particular to try to develop a solution which would be a standard solution. Because one of the other problems we identified is that with 50 states in the District of Columbia, there are 50 different sets of rules, 51 different sets of rules, that these military voters all need to try to follow. We would work with them again in a minute. They share a pragmatic, non-ideological, big government approach to solving problems. And like Pew, the Uniform Law Commission would rather get it right than get it done fast. And as it turns out, they also move pretty diligently forward.
The Uniform Law Commission is a great partner for AARP. Because of the Uniform Law Commission, older Americans have better laws on the books.
We really try to strike a balance. Should there be complete uniformity? No. If there will be complete uniformity, we can just eliminate the state boundaries and just call it one single unitary nation. But we started with the premise that this is not temporary, but these boundaries are permanent. They are a collection of states.
And what is remarkable is that after all these years as a nation with separate states, we have functioned fairly well. And I attribute a great deal of that success to the work of the Uniform Law Commission.
Mr. Chairman and members, that is the DVD that gives you the overview of the Uniform Law Commission. There is a one-page handout that attempts to summarize some of the more important features, that it is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I think as you heard in the DVD, it usually takes 2 to 3 years to develop a Uniform Act, and there's quite an elaborate drafting process that includes commissioners coming together in meetings to actually draft the act and listen to liaisons from the ABA, listen to observers from different interest groups, and then try to strike a balance. On the sheet, it also gives you our Minnesota Uniform Law Commissioners, and we do have a large group from Minnesota. You saw a number of them in the video. Both Bob Stein and Harriet Lansing are past presidents of the Uniform Law Commission, which means they volunteered to essentially, for no money, do a full-time job for 2 years for the Uniform Law Commission, and all of us volunteer our time. So with that, I don't know, Kim, if you have additional comments and if the committee has any questions.
Mr. Chair, I think my one additional comment would be, as a practitioner, you'll notice our commissioners are a little bit older. They've served a long time. So I'm sort of the junior member, but as a business law practitioner, I can't help but echo how important it is that we have uniform business laws. And that's really the highlight that comes out of the Uniform Law Commission. I also work on drafting our business statutes here in the state of Minnesota, which are not all off the Uniform Law Commission. So we use Model Acts for that, and we do all of that. But it's really important, I think, to understand or recognize the value of having that uniformity, is also having all the thought leadership that goes into these acts, because they're just, they have so many different points of views that we couldn't have just being here. And I think that's the real benefit of having all of us involved with the Uniform Laws Commission.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Walk me through this a little bit. Thank you for the presentation. The music was a strange flashback to another era. I was kidding Representative Lucero a little bit about it. As this group gets together and they meet and they discuss topics that would probably be in their interest to cover, clearly, I've been here long enough to understand that there are very few things that are nonpartisan. Issues, there's always someone that has an issue with something. And if they don't, they just don't know it yet, okay? And how does the Uniform Law Commission, how do they walk me through the decision-making process? They get an issue put before them that could be controversial or could be considered partisan. How do they make the final decision as to what to act on? Is there a vote, or how do they do that?
Ms. Jones?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. There's a multiple-step process. I mean, first of all, any proposed idea for an act has to go through the executive committee and be vetted and determine that a drafting committee will be established. And sometimes there's even a study committee first. Many times there is a study committee first to determine and make recommendations back to the executive committee whether the act makes sense, whether uniformity is needed, whether there is some hope of reaching consensus on a balanced position. If the study committee is successful in making, in recommending an act, and then a drafting committee is established, then it's a couple of years of doing the drafting, commissioners coming together and meeting, finding a reporter, usually a law professor with expertise in the area. And then once a proposed act is drafted, it'll come for a first reading at that annual conference. And so the annual conference of the Uniform Law Commission is not like any other conference that you've ever been to. It's like a miniature legislative session. Imagine, if you will, the drafting committee on a panel similar to all of you sitting at this table, and 350 lawyers in a great big room with about half a dozen microphones. Then the drafting committee prepares to read the act word by word, line by line, and after every section, you will see lines of lawyers lined up at the microphones, and they make comments. And then drafting is done on the floor. After the first reading, a whole nother year of drafting committee work occurs. Typically the second or third year, the act will come up for a final reading. Again, same process. Big panel of the drafting committee, they read that act line by line, word for word. It gets discussed. Edits and amendments are made. And then a final act is completed during that second or third meeting, whenever the act is up for final reading, and then there's a vote by the states on the final product. So it really takes a lot of thought, and there's a lot of work that goes into it.
Just a quick follow-up. So thank you for walking us through that process, and I'm glad I'm not part of that body. you've walked us through the creation process. I would assume that there are many issues that are demanding attention that that would potentially come before this body. So who is the decision making? How does the decision making process? Let's say you've got 10 issues that are hot button issues. You've got time to maybe do 4. So how are the final? Who decides what comes before the body, and how is that done?
Ms. Timmons?
Ms. Lowe will be taking this one.
Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair. There is what's called a scope and program committee, and all of these proposals bubble up through that committee. They're vetted. They're thought about. Does it need to be uniform? Is it something that we're never going to get to uniformity on? And you would be. There's many ideas that come up. I sat through scope and program last year, and literally there was like, do we need to have a uniform law about plastic bags? I mean, there are many, many ideas that bubble up through that process. And then the scope and program can be really then vets it, thinks about whether this is going to be something that's needed. How is it in an area that the uniform laws just don't go to because uniformity is not something that's possible? And then they put a study committee together. The study committee then looks at the law a little farther, looks at whether we need one. I'm on a study committee right now, and usually it's quite interesting. It's on looking at personal fundraising and whether or not there needs to be some uniform law with respect to all these GoFundMe activities. So it's a fascinating process, but we might not even enact a law, like even go to the next step. So everything is really vetted to think about whether it's even possible to get uniformity and whether it's an area that it's better left to the states to worry about it or individually, or if it should be something that should be uniform because it affects all the states and different and people populating and moving across states.
Just one final quick follow-up question. Then is there a place where we could get a roster of the gatekeepers, the scope and uniform committee? If you just offline, if you'd email that to us, and how the assignments on that works. It's always nice to know who the gatekeepers are and how that process works. Thank you.
Any other questions by the member? Ms. Timmons and Ms. Lowe, I want to thank you for coming here. The work you do is, from what it sounds like, is very difficult, very challenging, and I appreciate all the work you do. And just thinking about it, just in business, on the business side alone, for the stuff you bring forward, the implications and how it can affect business across this country if we don't have uniform laws, and how it can affect a lot of on the interstate trade, but also on the international trade as well. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, a brief overview on their operations. If you could please state your name and who you represent, we'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for having me today. My name is B.J. Jungman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Burnsville. I am here representing the Minnesota Fire Service Association Coalition, and our coalition represents 4 fire service organizations, the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota, and the International Association of Arson Investigators Minnesota chapter. So it's different segments of the fire service that all come together to work on legislative issues. I think the Chiefs Association is pretty self-explanatory. It's the leadership of fire departments that belong to that. The Fire Department Association tends to represent the members of many departments, particularly the volunteer and rural departments. The Fire Marshals Association is a coalition of the fire marshals from all of our cities, and then the arson investigators are the folks not only in the public sector and the fire service that investigate the fires in our state, but also the private fire investigators that work for the insurance companies and specialists in the arson investigation field. So I appreciate your time today. I think we're going to give you a quick overview of the fire service and where we're at today and where we're going.
Go ahead and continue.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So real quick, Minnesota has the second highest number of percentage of volunteer fire departments across the nation at 93%. So we are primarily served by volunteer firefighters, which has served us well for many, many years. And when you look at it, 687 of our fire departments of the 780 are considered all volunteer departments. There are 74 departments that are considered combination, where they have a combination of full-time and paid-on-call or volunteer staff. You may hear them referred to in different ways. There's very few true volunteer departments left out there. You hear them lots of times considered paid per call, so they might get paid $10 or $12 per call, whether that's a one-hour call or an eight-hour call. We still consider those volunteer departments. That's not a career or scheduled type of department. And then when you look at that, the vast majority of our departments are comprised of those volunteer firefighters. We estimated about 19,000 of the 21,000 firefighters in our state are considered volunteer or paid-per-call firefighters. So, again, primarily served by those in your community that live there that are willing to give their time to serve their community. When you compare that regionally, which is the graph on the bottom right there, when you look at the number of firefighters per 10,000 of population, we have the lowest total and the lowest career and volunteer firefighters. The red on that first graph is the career, and yellow is volunteer firefighters. Within that, the kind of upper right graph talks about the number of fire stations per 10,000 a capita. And again, when you look in our five-state region, we have the lowest number. And the same thing with the number of actual fire departments out of 780 fire departments in our state. So we make it work on a very efficient scale with very few people in comparison. So really, what does it take? Well, it takes a lot of money, really, to get a firefighter up and running. That's about $27,000. And that's just for the equipment and the training to get someone ready. And that's, we're not talking salaries. We're not talking anything else. So this is true. Whether you're a volunteer firefighter or whether you're a full-time firefighter, when you look at the amount of training that someone has to go through, when you look at the equipment that they need to be fully equipped as a firefighter, you're looking at about a $27,000 investment to go from street clothes and no education to being fully qualified to be a firefighter. One more statistic really on the spending is we're 47th in the nation, and actually in 2014 we moved up to 46th. The data hasn't been published yet on that. And at the same time, we're 21st in the nation on population. So a quick overview of what does the fire service provide? I think lots of times people think of fires and, you know, we pull up in a big red truck and put out burning buildings. Well, that's one of the service lines that we provide, but we do a lot more for the communities that we serve. So fire suppression is the one that you probably see the most. We also do fire prevention, and fire prevention really can mean a lot of different things in a lot of different communities, anything from inspections to fire investigations to public education. So there's a lot of things that fall under that fire prevention umbrella. We also do a lot of public education, and lots of times that's not just on fire prevention. It's how do people be safe in their – how can they be safe and healthier in their home? Things like not only checking their smoke detector, but do they have trip hazards? Do we have things that are going to keep them safer? We also do technical rescue at various levels, and technical rescue is anything from needing a rope rescue off the side of a water tower to a trench rescue to vehicle extrication for someone that's entrapped in a vehicle at a car accident. We do hazardous materials, so if something spills and it's harmful to people or the environment, we get called to those as well. And probably our biggest growing service line is the emergency medical services. As we have an aging demographic, we tend to see more and more medical calls. Regardless of whether your fire department provides the ambulance service, they're usually engaged at some level of first response in the EMS system because generally they're trained to provide medical aid to people within your community. And when you look at that growing population and the need for emergency medical services, the fire departments are generally pretty engaged, and you'll see that the call volume continues to rise there and is predicted to for a number of years to come. So then you go, what are the pressures on the fire service? What's really our driving factors? And I will tell you the number one is the recruitment and retention of volunteer firefighters. We hear this across the state. People's lives have changed. The expectations have changed. And really the recruitment is one issue. And you talk the changing demographics. Well, the millennials coming out have different values and have different things. They don't own as many homes as we used to. So even if you do get them, how long do they stay? Anecdotally, a lot of departments are saying they're lucky to keep these volunteers 5 years. Well, if they spend the first 18 months in training, you're getting 3 years out of these folks before they turn over. So that high turnover rate is very difficult. It's also difficult to get them to stay in that community. It's difficult to get them during the day. If you think at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday, if you have a fire and you're running a volunteer fire department, who's showing up? you hope that you have some shift workers that work overnight, so they work shift work somewhere else, so that you have a handful of folks. But really the recruitment is an issue, and then the retention is also an issue, as I talked about, kind of that five-year average. Resources, and that's both financial and the human piece. We talked a little about the recruitment and retention, which is our firefighters, which are our most valuable resource, and then really that financial piece. It continues to increase in cost providing the service. The equipment we buy becomes more and more expensive each year. The regulation and the things, the training that we need to provide continues to be more and more costly.
Mr. Jungman, I believe Representative Pinto has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, I'm curious your point about folks being trained but then moving after a couple of years and maybe move to a different community, that sort of thing. I'm just curious, is it common or becoming increasingly common? I guess I would hope so that that as folks are moving around, they might be trained in one community, but now they've got those skills, they could then join the as a volunteer firefighter in a different community. And moving between communities in that way, versus they get trained, they're there, but then once they leave, you know, they're lost entirely. Thank you.
Mr. Jungman?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that is correct. We do see some of that, but I would tell you a lot of times they're moving out of our state. These people are moving long ways, and the other thing is their career grows and their family grows. The ability for people to give the time that we need decreases. So generally you might see them move once, join another department for a couple years, and then they're done. So even though they might... You might get a couple of years out of them in a new department. Generally, you're not seeing them stay the 20 years we used to see. So yeah, you do see a little bit of movement of some trained firefighters, but that's really a small minority of the folks that are moving around.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pinto, any follow-up?
No.
Okay,
thank
you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Also, some unfunded mandates. I will give you an example. Is last year there was changes in the EMS education standards, so that create an unfunded mandate to the departments to maintain their EMS certifications and some changes in requirements in those departments to provide more training. Compliance with things like OSHA. We talked about hazardous materials compliance with the PCA regulations to make sure we're doing the right thing. That takes equipment, that takes time, that takes training of our folks. So there's a number of different standards out there. The sustainability of the current models is at jeopardy, I think. When you look at it, when we see that decreasing volunteerism, how do we continue to provide this service reliably to our communities? So we want to make sure that we do that into the future. So we're looking at what does the future model look like. And then that evolving health and wellness challenges. As we see really three primary drivers of that, and one of the associations that isn't here that we try to partner up with whenever we can is the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. That represents the union firefighters in the state, is really we're all seeing the same thing, whether you're volunteer full-time, is the cardiac stress on people and the increase in heart attacks, the increase in cancer that we have a hard time getting data on, and then the third one is the post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's across all of public safety, is we're seeing a lot more mental health with the things that all of the folks in public safety see. And it's not necessarily one instance. Lots of times it's the chronic. Over a 20-year career, the things that you see, you can't forget, and it's tough to deal with. So those are a quick rundown of some of the pressures that we see in the fire service. So one of the things that is very helpful in Minnesota is the fire safety account. I'm guessing most of you are pretty familiar with that, but that fire safety account is dedicated revenue that goes to the fire service, and statutorily it's really aimed at three things, and that's funding the state fire marshal's office, which is wholly funded out of the fire safety account, the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education, and the regional response teams. So as I talked about, the Fire Marshal's Office is a great asset to the fire service. They help us in a number of ways, from inspections and code enforcement to fire investigations to being a resource for fire departments and what their needs are and what the regulations are and how to get through those things. The Board of Firefighter Training and Education helps set standards and allows reimbursements to every fire department in the state. Currently, each fire department can get a minimum of $90 this year. With the funds we have, it'll be in excess of $100 and per firefighter per year. And that is very helpful for departments that don't have a training budget. Their training budget might be $1,000. Well, you might not be able to have more than one outside instructor come in per year for that kind of money to do the technical training we need. So this has opened the door to allowing a lot more training to come into the fire service. When you look at the regional response teams, the fire safety account funds the hazmat teams, which respond to those hazmat incidents and have the technical expertise. Again, this is great because we don't need every fire department to be a hazardous materials team. So it's a very efficient way to do that. The same with Task Force 1. Task Force 1 deals with structural collapse. They deal with high-angle rescue. They'll deal with trench rescue or any of those other technical rescues that we need help with. And they'll go anywhere in the state. And then the last and probably newest is the Minnesota Air Rescue team. And that is a partnership between St. Paul Fire and the Minnesota State Patrol, and using the helicopter that the State Patrol has to do rescues. And they've been called out a number of times and have had very successful results by having that team available. So, again, a very efficient way to leverage regional resources across the state instead of all of us being trying to have that expertise. When we look at evaluating the fire service moving forward, we have a training study underway through the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training Education that will help us look into the future of what the gaps are in fire service training. There was a rail response study that was just released in the past 2 weeks through HSEM, which helps us deal with what our gaps are with the rail emergencies and pipeline emergencies we're looking at. The regional response team study was completed in October, which has 17 recommendations that we're working with HSEM on to look for solutions for. Again, we talked about the fire safety account. That supports critical functions of the fire service. Without that money, the state fire marshal's office wouldn't exist. The training in many of these departments wouldn't exist, and these regional response teams would not exist. And they are very valuable to our state. We also have three fire service specialists in the state fire marshal's office, again, that help many departments navigate the waters of what's going on in the fire service and what assets are out there. And then we're looking at fire service organizations working collaboratively on these solutions, not only legislatively. When I talked about what is the future of the model, that's going to take all of us coming together. That's not necessarily a legislative effort, but we're committed to providing services, our mission is, to every community in the state, and we want to lead through that. And, again, it's not always legislative, but we want you to know that we know what some of the challenges are, and we're working to get those resolved or to have a goal.
Okay. Mr. Jungbauer, I believe Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I'm interested in several aspects of what you're discussing, but particularly want to ask you about the recruitment aspect and looking at our even high school students, mm-hmm. and informing them of options. I mean, you're really talking about something that would appeal to a lot of young people if they understood the challenges that you face, and it would be really interesting in so many aspects of what you've described. But what are the basic qualifications before you would hire someone and put them through training?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that all depends on the department, but I will tell you most volunteer departments need someone that's 18 or older that passes a background check and has basically a clean criminal record, and then they will put them through all the training after that. Most full-time departments are basically using the volunteer departments kind of as their field team because we have so many volunteer firefighters that they come qualified to most full-time departments. So most of those volunteer departments, again, 93% of the departments in the state have some very minimum qualifications and will provide all the training beyond that. So we're looking for good people that have a good work ethic and a good reputation that are willing to work hard.
Representative Ward, follow up.
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have or do any of the departments have any kind of recruitment, going to the job fairs or anything like that, even the college fairs that the schools have, so that kids know that there is an opportunity and they could have a vision of what they could do?
Mr. Jungbauer?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can't speak for every department in the state, but I can tell you most departments in the state have very heavy recruitment efforts in their local community in different ways. I can tell you that Burnsville attends the high school career fair. I can tell you that we partner with the colleges and we're on their advisory committees and we get in front of those students. So we make every effort to get some face time and explain what we're about and what the potential is. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Ford, any other?
No, thank you.
Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming down here today. A couple of quick questions. Someone joins the volunteer fire department, they serve, they get vested, they serve 7, 10, 15, whatever years. And when they're done, they don't make a lot of money because it's a volunteer type of organization. But one thing that we've always had to offer these folks is that if you put in your time when you are done, you're going to get a lump sum retirement check. And usually it's pretty good.
And it's money that's put away for that purpose. And I think it's an excellent excellent tool to attract people into the fire service. I have many of my coworkers who are also volunteers that's part of their retirement package. With that basis set, in Minnesota, once you retire and you draw that lump sum, what happens? You get taxed. You get taxed on your retirement. You get this big lump check, and then the state of Minnesota comes and takes a big bite out of it. I just happen to have a bill. So would it be helpful, in your opinion, to recruit and retain firefighters if they knew their retirement would be tax-exempt?
Mr. Jungbauer?
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, I think that's another recruitment tool. I don't think there's a singular approach that'll fix the problem, mm-hmm. but I do think that is advantageous and is definitely something that would attract people and that we could use as part of our recruitment and retention package.
Director Newberger, any follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one more quick question. And then also, you mentioned the EMT renewal process. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my heart goes out to you on that. They changed the standards. And I've been through that myself, and it's an arduous, torturous process. What it used to be to what it is now, in my opinion, is redundant, and I know that the EMSRB has a lot of input on that. Is it your opinion that, because we need EMTs in the volunteer services because these are the folks that are responding in greater Minnesota, is it your opinion that the new renewal standards or the mechanisms by which you renew your EMT, is that a detriment? Are you losing EMTs because of that?
Mr. Jungman?
Mr. Chair and committee members, what I've heard is that it's definitely hurting our rural areas, and it's pushing a lot of people to go from EMT down to EMR, the first responder.
Mm-hmm.
So we're losing EMTs to go down to the emergency medical, which is a step below that,
mm-hmm.
Is what I'm hearing. I couldn't tell you firsthand. I know it was a challenge for us and a challenge for a number of the agencies that I've talked to. I think it's still too new to say what the outcome is going to be, but I do definitely think it is impacting our rural areas with the ability to retain the EMT-level provider. Without an ambulance service, it's very difficult for these folks to keep up that EMT.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newberger, any more follow-up? Hey, Mr. Youngman, if you want to continue, but I'd like to respond to our members. Might be something we need to look at and find out if these new standards are hurting greater Minnesota, especially with the distances that the ambulance sometimes have to run. It's the fire departments that make the difference it could make a difference in lives. So if you want to continue.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. So moving forward, again, what are we doing? The training study, the rail response study, the regional response teams, again, with partnership with many of the DPS divisions. We talk about the fire safety account, the state fire marshal's office, and then us working together to accomplish what our gaps are. So some of our legislative initiatives this year, first and foremost is to get the appropriation for the base budget of this fire safety account. We would like to allocate $12.9 million of that money to those three topics we talked about, the State Fire Marshal's Office, the Board of Firefighter Training and Education, and the regional response teams. The second piece is a little bit of that, talking about the future, is enabling fire taxing districts. If you look west of Minnesota, Colorado, Washington State, Oregon, California, there's a whole bunch of states that have enabling legislation that allow local municipalities to create fire taxing districts. Instead of just a joint powers agreement. We have one under special legislation in Minnesota. That would be the Cloquet Area Fire District. This would allow two or more local units of government to come together to create a special taxing district and provide fire and EMS service to their communities, or at least fire service, depending on how they're licensed. The third one is we would like to move the fire code from the Department of Labor and Industry to the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety, or the fire code, is the only code that is not adopted by the agency that's required to enforce the code. Our goal here is to still continue to work collaboratively with the Department of Labor and Industry. The fire code and the building code are really tied together, and what we saw in the last code adoption process is they weren't adopted concurrently. The Department of Labor and Industry does not have the staff to do that, and we believe working concurrently with them and hopefully to have a same or similar adoption date would be very helpful. And I can tell you in Burnsville's experience, we went 15 months with a different fire code than a building code. So I have a building official saying one thing and a fire official saying something different, and it gets confusing for those that are pulling permits. So we'd like to get that process aligned. We have some cleanup for the PERA provision on the Hometown Heroes Act that was in last year's omnibus pension bill that would require PERA to follow the Department of Public Safety's, Commissioner of Public Safety's determination whether it's a line of duty death or not, so that, that the grieving families don't have to go through multiple processes to get their benefits. We would like to advocate for inspecting private and parochial schools. Currently, only public and charter schools are inspected, and we think that all the kids in the state need to have a fire inspection to make sure that their school is safe. And then we want to eliminate the use of cancer-causing flame retardants. We got four of those chemicals adopted, I think it was 3 years ago, 2014-2015 time frame. There's six more chemicals that are showing, the flame retardants are showing to cause cancer in firefighters. And then the last thing is we continue to work with Homeland Security and the rail industry on rail safety initiatives to make sure we have the information and response capabilities in the event we were to have something like that in Minnesota. So that is a quick overview of everything we have going on. I could talk a lot longer. It was a very high-level overview. I really appreciate your time, your interest in the fire service, and your support of the fire service. It means a lot to us. My contact information is up at the top, and feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions or concerns or any thoughts.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned in one of your slides that you're looking at the sustainability of the current models and that you are looking at other models in the future. Could you share with us a little bit what those models look like?
Mr. Youngman.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the fire taxing district is a perfect example of one of those. Is can two or more communities come together and be more efficient? I can tell you, the name of the two departments slipped away from me, but Central Minnesota, two rural departments came together to create one department, and they consolidated to one fire station. So instead of having two 40-member departments, they were able to consolidate to one 40-member department and finally have the staff they need to run that volunteer fire department. So things like that, making it easier so departments can consolidate and be more efficient would be an example of that, of a way to do that. As well as looking, if we do have to hire staff, what's the best way to do that and use them economically and efficiently. And again, I think that model of collaboration is really the future of the fire service.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've observed that you get a lot of your funding from the fire safety account. The legislature makes those allocations as well. So my question is, do you receive any reimbursement for any of your responses? For example, if you have responses to a train derailment, do you receive any reimbursement for the acts that you take in the event that someone is handling chemicals in hazardous materials in a manner that's improper and it results in you coming out? Do you receive any reimbursement of your costs for that? And if so, how do you get it, and what do you use it for?
Mr. Young, gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the easy answer is it depends. But realistically, that's up to the local jurisdiction to figure out if in their fee schedule, if they have that allocated, that they can bill back to the responsible party. What I would tell you is most often in the hazardous materials world, particularly with the regional response team, is we've created a fund that allows us to pay for the chemical assessment team, the regional team that comes out, and reimburse them if there's a responsible party. If there's not a responsible party, there's a fund set up to reimburse the regional response team for the response. But the local municipality is up to that local unit of government to have that in their fee schedule and to charge the responsible party.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the local jurisdiction then would find someone, for example, criminally responsible or civilly responsible for their conduct, and then they would go after them, and you then potentially could get some reimbursement for those.
Mr. Jungman.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is correct. Many times it doesn't necessarily have to be a legal battle. Lots of times once there's an insurance company involved, we can work with them to figure out the reimbursement process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what fund does that go into, just the local jurisdiction, or do you get some of that? And then who determines how that's spent?
Mr. Youngman.
Mr. Chair and committee members. So the state takes care of the reimbursement of the regional response teams and that'll go directly to the direct costs of the regional response teams to respond, the personnel costs and the equipment that was used, the disposables, things like that. And so there's really two different bills that would happen. From the state aspect, HSEM, Homeland Security Emergency Management, would take care of the regional response billing and get that money back to reimburse that department that responded, because each of those regional response teams are hosted by a fire department. So that department would be reimbursed. The local unit of government, it would be up to them what they'd use that for, but generally it's got to be direct costs associated with that response to reimburse the department for disposables and time spent on that response.
Final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And who would have the data? Who would I request the data from of anybody that was held accountable, how much money was actually collected, and how much any local unit of government might have been reimbursed?
Mr. Jungman?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that would be Homeland Security Emergency Management for the state side. I will tell you that I believe that fund is somewhat new, so I don't know how much data has been collected yet. And then it would be up to local units of government for the city type of reimbursement or local reimbursement. It's going to be difficult to get in a local environment because they don't happen very often, thankfully. But I don't know if there's a lot of data out there.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Representative Hillstrom was just talking about, when I was on the City Council in Mankato, we had 1,600 medical calls, and I noticed you said that's the fastest growing. What we discovered was a significant number of them were going to nursing homes and assisted living where I've fallen and I can't get up, and there was insufficient staff, or the person was somebody like me and they couldn't pick them up. So I think we need to also look at reimbursement from those private entities when they're failing to staff their institutions with the ability to take care of their folks.
Thank you, Representative. If I remember right, I've been looking into that issue myself, and there's, because of some of the way the statutes are, I think fire departments are having a problem billing on medical calls.
We can change that.
We can change. Like I say, I've been looking into that issue. But there's some other issues to deal with that. Representative Dean.
One quick question. We had some testimony the other day about forest fires and recovery of costs associated with forest fires from individuals who may have been arsons. Do you have any indication or any knowledge of how many times the state or the agency, whoever it was, has gone after an individual, and what type of funds were actually recovered from that individual?
Mr. Jungman?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm not aware of any. I think that would be a good question for DNR. The Department of Natural Resources really handles that, and anything significant they're involved in. So I would think they'd probably be the more appropriate agency to ask of that. I don't have any information that would be helpful.
Okay, just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So you all haven't gotten any money to help with, you know, some of these different areas of firefighters' funds and things. You haven't gotten any money from DNR or from the state specifically that you know about?
Mr. Jungman?
Mr. Chair and committee members, so there's a couple of programs through the DNR. One's a volunteer grant, a 50-50 grant that matches for equipment for departments that are $10,000 or less for wildland fire equipment. So there's that. I know when they get to a certain point, they may be reimbursable if a disaster declaration is declared or if there's a responsible party. I would tell you I personally haven't been involved in anything that big where I could speak to what the reimbursement is. I know there's a process if they're able to recapture that, but I don't know of anybody getting a lot of money from that. And I'm not aware of anybody getting money back from that, but I know that if you're deployed for a number of days, there's a way to get reimbursed, particularly those departments that rural departments that partner with the DNR. There's a rate for a fire engine to go out or a grass rig to go out and assist them. I don't know what that threshold is, and I don't know how often it's used.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, Mr. Young, Jungman, I want to thank you for coming here. I want to thank all the volunteer firefighters out there. We learned there's about 19,000 of them. I give them a lot of credit because I, as a former volunteer firefighter, I know how much time, how much training that's taken away from their families, and we need to do some work to try to do some things for them because it's very important to the safety of our public. They've done a great job in fire prevention. Fires across the state are down, but their calls are up because of increasing medical costs. Ambulance service, they're changing things around, and they're stepping up to the plate to cover those areas and helping out. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we'll have the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers for a short overview. If you please state your name for the committee, and go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Rick Larkin. I am the president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and with me today I have John Bowen, who is the Emergency Management Director for Cowan County, and Gary Johansson, who is the Environmental Services Director and Emergency Management Director for Norman County. And we thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee. Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers is a longstanding association that you may not have heard of. Unlike our brothers and sisters in the fire service or law enforcement or emergency medical services, we tend to be behind-the-scenes folks. And that's actually the way we like it. Our motto is Hero Support. And we're the folks behind the scenes, a little bit like the folks at NASA Mission Control, supporting success in the field. Our association is comprised of over 440 emergency management professionals around the state. And what we try and do for our association is provide a network of experienced emergency management folks to help advocate for common procedures, advanced preparedness techniques, and really supporting our communities through emergency preparedness. We come from all over the state, and my friends here, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing that they wear multiple hats, but they're both actually in town for another training session. But we wanted to make sure that you understand that we have emergency management professionals all around the state. Our six regions mirror the Department of Public Safety regions, and we have regional representatives throughout. We're a very active association. So what is emergency management? Most people immediately go to our traditional first responders, the police officers, the firefighters, the medical emergency folks, and many of those are emergency managers. But again, we're sort of this folks behind the scenes enabling that support and coordination for those large-scale emergencies. I was going to show a video, but I don't have a Supreme Court justice in my video, so I'm just going to encourage you at the end of our slide presentation, if you have 5 minutes in your office, which I know sometimes you don't, but if you do, look up the Essential Emergency Manager, and it's a very quick 4.5-minute video that talks about the duties of an emergency manager, and it kind of gives some good, cute little visuals, and it's a little cartoonish, but it actually shows the principles of coordination and situational awareness and information sharing. Those are kind of the key things for emergency managers. We do those things throughout a continuum or four cycles. Everything we do is pretty cyclical, although we can bounce around the continuum, unfortunately. But the classic example of emergency management is there are four phases, starting with mitigation or prevention. The legislature provides flood control to the DNR. And the emergency managers at the local level are the folks that work with building officials, planning and zoning folks, to prevent emergencies and disasters, or at least minimize the damages. The next phase is preparedness. Preparedness is all about planning, training, and exercising. And just this morning, as an example, I stopped in at the Union Depot here in town, where the Minnesota National Guard and our local fire department hazardous materials folks were having an exercise together. So on that very bad day where they would have to join together, they're going to have experience and practice. So that's preparedness. Response, of course, is what makes the news, but it's actually the shortest part of the cycle. Response is, and our role in response is not to be responders, although many of us are. Our role is really more about resource coordination and resource support behind the scenes so those folks in the field get what they need to be successful. And then lastly, recovery. Recovery is the longest piece, and that's about facilitating the community goals and stakeholder involvement. That's the role of the emergency managers, to help facilitate. Again, I'm using terms like facilitate, coordinate, support. That's what we do. Recovery is more about restoration of the community. So a lot of folks will think that emergency managers are only kind of waiting around for the big one to occur. And in fact, our work is not seasonal, and it's not based upon just disaster events or large-scale events. Our work is continuous in preparedness, planning, training, exercising, prevention, those types of things. So we have folks all across the state that are actively involved in those phases, working on natural hazards as well as human-caused hazards, whether they're intentional or accidental, or what we call technological hazards, the built environment perhaps having issues. And just to refresh your memory, these are some pictures that we have of emergencies and disasters all around the state that you'll all be very familiar with. The bridge collapse in 2007, the success of the response piece was enabled by thorough preparation between multiple agencies, the Duluth flooding in 2012, catastrophic flooding. And then my friend John has experienced significant issues in his area of their state with significant rainfall and wind events, but not only just by themselves, but successive back-to-back events. And he has some information about that. We also have the human-caused or hazardous materials-type emergencies. You'll recall the Callaway train derailment from earlier this year. And then our most recent disaster here in the state, the South Central Minnesota flooding, that has really been a challenge for our fellow Minnesotans in that area. And you can see that the infrastructure is definitely affected in this particular case, as it always is. So as I mentioned, mitigation is that prevention, working with planning and zoning folks on lessening the potential damage. Preparedness is all about planning, training, and exercising, bringing the right folks to the table. One of the things I love about our emergency management friends is that we're really good at networking, and most of us are kind of those born connectors. Do you know so-and-so is working on this over here in another department? You know, the disaster scene is not the place to hand out business cards. So we try and encourage that connection in that preparedness phase and work together as much as we can. Response, again, that's fairly self-explanatory, but we're in the coordination role and the support role and the resource role. We don't have command and control of those things. That's maybe where the mission control breaks down a little bit, but really it's the folks in the field that are in charge, and we're there bringing all the necessary support to make sure that they're successful. And then rebuilding and cleanup in recovery. That's actually where these guys are headed later today and tomorrow to talk about debris management and environmental health following disasters. So just briefly, kind of that's what we do, who we are. One of our most important mechanisms from the state government, and we're very grateful for this foresight in 2014, was the State Disaster Assistance Account that was created. Our association for years had advocated for that creation of the State Disaster Assistance Account, and it's been very successful since its adoption in 2014. The biggest benefit, and I don't know if it's a good thing that you sort of exercise a disaster assistance account. You know, it would be best if we just had one and we didn't have any disasters. But unfortunately, we've had quite a few. And the communities across our state have been able to get their assistance much quicker than having to either call a special session or come back into session with a deficiency request versus having that disaster assistance account created to support that local government. So we're very appreciative of that. Just some information about that. It's been utilized 13 times at the state level disasters since 2014. And my partner John has probably been our leading candidate for assistance to his neck of the woods. About $30 million has been processed through that account, and only two of those disasters have led to federal declarations. So the state disaster assistance is, designed to bridge that gap between really nothing and the federal assistance. And so this has been very helpful to our communities. 34 counties, 5 tribal nations that encompass about 300 local jurisdictions. And I do want it to be known that most of those counties and local jurisdictions are outside of the metro ring. So the threshold has been very helpful in providing support to greater Minnesota as well as to our metro folks, but the majority have been outside of the metro area. Some of the challenges that we face, I know that your job is tough because we're all coming to you with challenges, but thanks for the opportunity to put that discussion forward. As with just about everything, we're seeing a reduction in federal funding for emergency management, and we're talking about the core support mechanisms, the federal grants that are passed through to locals. Our association, and this is not in conjunction with the governor or the agency by any means, this is our association, independently has been on record as saying we feel there's insufficient general fund appropriations for the agency, DPS, specifically the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And the reason is because they want to free up more of those dollars and the grant dollars to come to the locals. But the uncertainty of grant funding and the reactionary nature of the federal programs really gets in the way of being able to have that sustained funding to support the local level. And unfortunately, our local folks are challenged as well. Emergency management really is a core public safety service. However, it's certainly compared to some of the others, it's not as visible and it's not something that we do every day. So it's difficult to maintain those funding levels at the local level. We have many communities are combining emergency managers, which we're concerned about because if you have one person that's shared between two counties, if one county has a disaster and it also affects the next county, where do they go? How do they facilitate the recovery for twice as much work? And it's been a very difficult challenge. And we certainly recognize the challenge at the local level. The disaster assistance account has been excellent. We're concerned about increasing eligibility for very large ticket disaster items, for instance, electrical co-ops, which we want to make sure we include, but their disasters are pretty large scale and very expensive. When you have an ice storm that takes down 500 poles and X number of miles of wire, that's very expensive. So we're supportive of increasing the eligibility. However, we're hopeful that that would come with a recognition that the dollars, obviously, when you have more folks drawing from that account, will be going a little less equally across the state. So Very quickly, Mr. Chair, those are our particular points we wanted to share with you as an overview. We certainly have a lot more than that, but in the interest of time, we'll stand for any questions.
Representative Ward has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I'm interested in, you've talked about partners and such, but I haven't heard about the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm assuming that that's one of your partners and wondered how you coordinate with them.
Mr. Chair, members, our health department, not only our state health department, but our local departments of public health are very key partners. If you would, the larger emergency management and coordination of an event is the responsibility of the local emergency manager. The specific discipline-related things, like if it's a pandemic outbreak or some other disease of the week that, you know, we have to worry about, our friends in the health department are really guiding us as the main operations folks. So we're very closely knit. As a matter of fact, many of our members that are the director of emergency management are embedded in the health department at the local level. But certainly the state, Minnesota Department of Health, and Minnesota Department of Public Safety have a senior advisory group, which all of the associations are present and working together on applying for grants and equipment and building capabilities together. So we are very closely aligned with them.
Any other questions? Do you have anything further?
I don't think so, if you don't have questions.
Well, I want to thank you for coming here. I know the work for the emergency management role in the county and at the city level is very daunting. You have a lot of responsibility, and unfortunately a lot of people in the communities don't even know who they are. Mm-hmm. But I believe that's what you want, because you're in the background doing the work and you're making the getting the information out there so the frontline people can do their jobs properly. I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we're going to have an overview from the County Probation Services, and we're going to start with Stephen King from the MACPO.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. By way of introduction, my name is Steve King. I'm the director of Moore County Corrections down in Austin, Minnesota. I'm pleased and honored to be here before you, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss for my presentation, the community or county probation model. For the information of the members, Minnesota operates under three delivery systems for distributing probation services in the state, and I think a lot of times we as directors kind of get in our own way by intimating to the legislature that it's confusing. And it really isn't, I don't think, confusing. I don't want to insult your intelligence, because it's really not confusing. The theme I'd like to hit on with these three delivery systems and how we operate is two things, choice and partnership. All three of the entities that exist today get along famously. We all serve on committees together. We're all invited to tables for initiatives so that everybody's voice is heard if there's changes or if there's important issues in the corrections community. One recent example to stress is just last week I was invited to serve on a four-member panel for hiring a new interstate compact deputy. That position is housed in the Department of Corrections, but out of those four panel members, we had one representative, myself, from the county probation model, and one representative from the Community Corrections Act county. So the DOC realizes, we in county probation, I'm sure my partners in CCA, realize that this is a partnership that we do together. Probation services, if I'm a probation officer in my neighboring Olmsted County, which is a Community Corrections Act county, probation services in Moore County as opposed to Olmsted County are the same. The duties and tasks of a probation officer are identical no matter where you're going throughout the state. I've had the fortunate luxury of being one of a handful of people in my career to actually work in all three delivery systems. And I can tell you firsthand that as I got plucked from Todd Laudina Community Corrections to the Department of Corrections to now Moore County Corrections, the business of probation is the same. The only difference I would stress, and the only people that know the difference, would probably be directors. because it's kind of how you get your funding is the difference. But the actual supervision, the tasks of writing pre-sentence investigations, doing violations, holding offenders accountable, working for the courts, it's all very similar. But I just want to stress that the two, it's always good to have choice. I think what works in Moore County may not work in Olmsted County. What works in Olmsted County might not work in Moore County. So I think as it goes, counties deserve that choice. And with that choice doesn't mean that it's confusing. It means that generally what works here is working. If it's not working, there's a choice to change it. And that's beautiful too. But the reality is all three delivery systems thrive. All three delivery systems have outstanding professional probation ranks that do outstanding work every day. It's getting difficult by the day. We are challenged with mental illness. We are challenged with the chemical dependency issues. Meth and heroin are really kicking our butt. We don't have an answer to those things, but we every day we try hard to find solutions. These solutions are found collaboratively. I'm not living in a vacuum in Austin, Minnesota. I'm engaging my partners in the Department of Corrections or in the Community Corrections Act. We all share the same database. So if I get plucked out of Austin, Minnesota and got sent to Hennepin County, I could navigate through the database because it's exactly the same that I use in Austin, Minnesota. We are all tied together through those information technology aspects. Probation, I believe in Minnesota right now we're at about 105,000 people on probation. The state of Minnesota is very probation-centric. We incarcerate very few, and we put on probation very many, which I think serves the taxpayers well. Our goal and our partnerships with other Community Corrections Act counties and DOC counties is to provide public safety. That doesn't change by going to each delivery system. The delivery system, we all have the same initiatives. In fact, while we have associations that are just solely for county probation officers, we have Association for Community Corrections Act, and we have a big umbrella, Minnesota Corrections Association, that is an umbrella for everybody. And in that organization, professional association, we share the identical initiatives as they relate to public safety. Again, if you want to have a discussion on how the funding source is, that's a different conversation. But my feeling is, and just speaking as my model in county probation, is we rely heavily upon the DOC. They right now fund us at about 31% of our salaried employees for probation. I get that there's always room for more. We always want more. But who before you doesn't talk about wanting more money? That's always going to be an issue. What we rely upon when the funding is short from the state is the county tax levy. So you may have some constituents out in the county that say, jeepers, the county boards are being put upon. And I recognize that, and I try to alleviate that by incorporating offender fees, kind of a pay-to-play. So if we have offender fees, I think almost all agencies do. I don't think there's one that doesn't. So offenders, as they come into our system, pay a certain fee for being on supervision and the money that might take. So, again, I want to keep this brief because I know time is of the essence, and my friends Mitch and Mr. Cleveland need to speak too. But if I could make any kind of impact on you today, I would stress those things. Choice, partnership. Both are choice is excellent. Partnership is very important. We are all in this game together. So thank you very much, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We get asked a lot by folks to put in rules about when you can violate a probation, when you can send someone back to prison, when you can do all sorts of things. We get asked to do that here at the legislature. You all work together in this three-tier model. Do you set up best practices committees and look at what each other do in terms of early release from probation and when it is in the best interest of folks to give a sanction other than in custody or shipping someone to prison? Or how does that work?
I would say the answer, I'm sorry, Representative, or Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say that the answer to that would be yes. We are heavily involved in evidence-based practices. We are engaged in activities that are trying to keep the population institutions low. Our population, we don't serve the felony population other than juveniles. We service the juvenile felonies. but we have a gross misdemeanor and misdemeanor caseload. That's our caseload. That is the true difference between county probation officer and the CCA model, is we aren't at this point supervising felons. We do pretrial work with our felons, so we do share some cases, but as it goes, the needs of the offender are the same, no matter what level of offense. Those needs being chemical dependency largely and mental health largely. But we do work collaboratively with other agencies to try to learn what they're doing best, what may work, to incorporate that in county corrections.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. And so in doing that, do you then do, you know, evidence-based practices? Because we're starting to see some data that, you know, if someone's not going to get sent to prison for a long time, if you actually put them in custody for more than 10 days, they have a higher likelihood of losing their housing and getting kicked out of their programming. And do you take those kinds of things into account as you're working on your best practices?
Mr. King.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do. This is another important partnership. We rely upon the Department of Corrections, who has a research unit and has capabilities of kind of working those numbers for us to help us. We use screening tools, risk needs-based screening tools, to help us work around the offender's needs and get them on supervision. Our agency, as a county probation officer, I always like to say we're a little more nimble. We don't have the bureaucracy and the layers of government. So to your question about early discharge from supervision, the DOCNO has an initiative now that they're working through to set standards on who and when and how they do early discharges from supervised release and probation. Moore County, we are nimble. There's me as the director, and there's eight agents, and I work at the pleasure of the judges. So as long as the judges are okay with my decision, that decision gets made instantly. So if I feel an offender has met their conditions of the court, they maybe have a two-year probation sentence, but they've met their conditions within a year, and their structure is excellent, their family, their employment, everything's going well, or your analysis have been fine, then we're going to cut that person loose with a discharge report, perhaps, or not. But the agreement I have with the judges that I work for are, is if we don't need to supervise those that really don't have any conditions and are going in the right direction, because evidence will show by supervising people that don't need it or at a level they don't need makes them actually worse.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to ask something very similar, and then in your answer you actually got to it, which was talking about the length of probation, talking about early release, and the best practices, what Representative Hillstrom was just talking about, I was hoping to hear what you were saying, is that you're starting to use some best practices and looking at each individual to say, you know, do they need to be supervised, or do we need, you know, because it seems like probation in some cases have gotten so long that it's no longer relevant and not helpful, as you just pointed to. So I'm glad to hear that. That was essentially what I was going to ask. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question also is related to best practices, but specifically related to domestic violence. And I'm just wondering what kind of emphasis you put on that, what kind of training. And then second, related to that, we talk a lot about training for law enforcement, you know, talking about police officers, but probation plays a really important role there. So I'm wondering if you have the resources that you need to have the training you need.
Mr. King.
Mr. Chair, Representative. When I got to be the director of Moore County Corrections 12 years ago, we didn't have in place a domestic violence. We didn't have a group or anything to help our offenders. What we did have was a few counties away and cost some money. It's always tough when these offenders largely don't have driver's license, don't have money to pay for these things. So I recognize that. And again, this goes to the nimbleness of county probation. Recognizing the need, I sent two probation officers to be trained in the Duluth model domestic violence, and now we have on board for the last 5 years a domestic violence class, a 26-week domestic violence class that is proven as it goes. You know, Duluth, the state of Minnesota, is a model in putting that training out there. So we do use that. Our law enforcement community, we are very collaborative with. We don't serve many masters in county probation. Again, the nimbleness, there's no layers of bureaucracy. We work out of the courthouse. Law enforcement is our neighbor. We do ride-alongs. They are engaged when they are. Our drug detective is always in their office looking at some offenders to help them do buys under confidential informants. So we work very collaboratively with our law enforcement as well.
Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question about funding and the challenges that counties face with the workload that they have. Could you give us some background on that, please?
Sure. I have a pretty responsive county board. As much as I say that I work at the pure pleasure of the judges, we are county employees. I recognize that we have to work together. So anything I report, and I report at least twice a year formally to the board, and my budget has to be approved by the county board. So they understand the importance of that subsidy or that reimbursement that the DOC gives us. I make it very clear when I see the numbers, I am not to throw anybody under the bus because everybody knows the pickle that everybody's in. If the funding's not there, they can't give it to us. So now let's be creative. We'd love the funding to be there, but if it's not, we got to be creative. And so they don't want to spend any more on the tax levy. They also get that we can't put upon the offender. As much as I say we have offender fees that help support the total package, I waive about 50% of the offender's fees. Every day I'm waiving a fee for indigents or whatever that might be because they just can't afford it. So the county board and the funding is, they're all aware of each other. I can say that. If I had the magic wand, it certainly takes more money to provide more resources. But again, when you're an operation without a lot of overhead and a lot of bureaucracy, we can make change, like adding a domestic violence group. We're very program heavy. In the rural community, it is harder to find resources for our offenders. So with that, we do our own in-house COG skills groups. We do our in-house domestic violence groups. We do some CD evaluations in-house. So those kind of things we're taking on. And the probation officer's load is increasing because as these things come down, somebody's got to do it. And thank goodness I have people that are happy to help me out in that area.
Thank you. Well, Mr. King, I want to thank you for being here today. Members, we have two more testifiers yet, so we need to
thank you.
17 minutes. Next up, we'll put Mr. Cleveland. And he is with MACCAC.
Morning.
Mr. Cleveland, if you cannot get that running, we do have copies of the slides in front of us.
Thank you very much. My name is Tim Cleveland, and I am the director in Scott County Community Corrections. I am also the current president of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Counties.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Midge Christensen. I'm the community corrections director for four counties directly west of here, Chippewa, Lac La Parle, Swift, and Yellow Medicine. And I'm also the legislative chair for the MACAC agency.
Again, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify this morning. What we're going to talk about is what community supervision looks like in Community Corrections Act counties. Just a quick overview, we're going to touch on the county's role in providing community supervision in community corrections, what community supervision looks like, and then Midge is going to talk a little bit more specifically about violations and revocations, and then resource needs. The Community Corrections Act was written into statute in 1973, and it is contained in Chapter 401, and it states in that statute, for the purpose of more effectively protecting society and to promote efficiency and economy in the delivery of correctional services, The Commission of Corrections is authorized to make grants to assist counties in the development, implementation, and operation of community-based correctional programs and facilities for detention or confinement, care and treatment of persons convicted of crimes or adjudicated delinquent. There are currently 33 counties participating in the Community Corrections Act. Now, while some of those larger counties have actually developed and operate juvenile detention and residential treatment facilities for adults and juvenile offenders, the primary core services that all of our Community Corrections Act counties provide is probation and supervised release supervision of all juvenile and adult misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and felony offenders. While we only have 33 counties participating in the Community Corrections Act, we actually supervise 72% of all probationers and 64% of all supervised releasees across the state. What's interesting to note is that for all the felony probationers that we supervise, only 5% of those individuals will have their probation revoked and committed to prison in any given year. If you look on your sheets there, you'll see the slide that represents the 33 counties participating in the Community Corrections Act. You'll notice that 6 of the 7 metro counties are Community Corrections Act counties. And for those counties that are shaded in the same color, they have formed together under joint powers agreements to administer their corrections program. So, for instance, DFO Community Corrections consists of Dodge, Filmer, and Olmsted counties. So the primary goal for Community Corrections, which is true for our other partners, is to ensure public safety by reducing the offender's risk to reoffend for those individuals who are under our supervision. We do that by increasing the offender's competencies, promoting offender change, and holding offenders accountable. Now, while we do bail evaluations for those individuals who are detained in our local jails upon the commission of a new crime, and some of our counties actually do provide pretrial services such as drug testing for offenders that are placed on conditional release. Okay. Our work really begins with the pre-sentence investigation of felony offenders. This is the time when somebody's been convicted of a new felony crime, and our staff gather information about that particular crime, the defendant, victim information. We really are helping the judge determine what the appropriate sentence should be. We also are responsible for completing those sentencing guidelines worksheets, and we do risk assessments on all these individuals. We really rely on a risk needs assessment to help us and the courts determine who are the most likely to commit future crimes. But it's all, those risk tools also guide us in determining what risk factors we can target our probation interventions on, and also what probation conditions can target and reduce their risk of reoffending. Once an individual is placed on probation, we use that risk assessment to assign supervision levels based on their risk, and we provide the more intensive services for the highest risk offenders. And we also use that risk assessment tool to determine what are the targets that we're going to hone in on in terms of our case planning and work with that individual. We do use a variety of evidence-based practices, such as motivational interviewing and cognitive behavioral interventions, with the ultimate goal of changing offenders' behavior and reducing their recidivism. One of the other responsibilities, we connect offenders with appropriate services in the community. That might be chemical dependency treatment, mental health services, domestic abuse treatment, sex offender treatment, just to name a few. And it does vary. Those services vary around the state, particularly in rural Minnesota. And we're also responsible for enforcing conditions of probation on behalf of the court. So for those individuals who are released from prison, it's called supervised release. And in Community Corrections Act counties, as is true in the counties that the Department of Corrections manages, we are responsible for supervising those individuals. And an offender may return to a community that which they lived in. It may not be the same community they committed their crime, but we've got an agreement across the state that we will accept those individuals. We're involved in release planning with the case managers at the institution. We're trying to find the best opportunity for that person to be successful. And with like probation, we're assigning their case based on their risk, and we are also connecting them with appropriate services in the community. And we use the same evidence-based practices with these individuals as we do with probation clients. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Midge and have her discuss probation violations and revocations.
We know based on...
Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, before we get into the probation violations, I want to talk a little bit about the risk assessments that you make. How do you ensure that your risk factors are actually risk-based and likely to reoffend and not just poverty factor or some cultural or race-related issues? What tools do you use to make certain you're actually measuring the proper measures?
Mr. Chair, Representative, all three delivery systems use a validated risk assessment tool. We currently use the level of service case management inventory for adult offenders. We use some other specialized tools in the sex offender arena that are more targeted for those individuals. We have specialized risk tools for domestic abuse offenders and also for repeat DWI offenders, but the primary tool is that tool, which is based out of Canada, and we use a similar tool for juveniles, the youth level of service inventory, which has been validated.
Mr. Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I asked the last service provider or testifier about best practices. Do you meet as well to talk about best practices in the risk assessment factors as well and what you do to ensure recidivism?
With all of our delivery systems, we really do work together. We have a variety of trainings across the state. In the last 20 years, we have done so much in this area. We have learned so much about what's really effective with changing offender behavior. So we collaborate together on trainings. In fact, there's a current group of Department of Corrections, Community Corrections, and Court Services agents that are looking at, and I can't remember the term, but just basically how we can improve and continue to enhance the skills that our probation officers have. And we've been doing it for many years, and we support each other. We as part of the Community Corrections Act subsidy, we need to spend 2% of the subsidy dollars on training efforts, and we focus most all of that training on evidence-based practices. We currently are going to be sponsoring a training March 2nd and 3rd, and we will be the primary training is for agents on evidence-based practices.
Okay. Ms. Christensen, you want to continue?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We know, based on your questions last week from the Department of Corrections presented their piece and also from your questions this morning, that you are interested in learning more about particularly the felony probation process and revocation because that directly impacts your state budget with regard to prison beds. So we thought we would share just a little bit and drill down on how we manage that in the field and what we're looking at and also the need for resources to respond to those potential violations. We know in Minnesota that felony probationers have significantly lower recidivism rates than supervised releasees. For instance, the Department of Corrections just released their most recent recidivism report, and felony probationers in Minnesota discharged in 2012, at 3 years out, only had a felony violation reconviction rate of 85%. But supervised releasees during that same period had a reconviction felony rate of 71%. So we know that if folks get to prison, if you cross that plane and you get to prison, you're going to have worse outcomes. We know that. For that reason, we are very interested and invested for the purposes of achieving long-term public safety in preventing folks from getting to prison.
And the way we do that is if you are placed on probation, felony probation in the community first, we need to do everything we can to make sure that that probation is successful. We don't want you to get to prison because we know from those recidivism factors that you're going to have a worse outcome coming out the back end. So how do we handle violations in the community? What do we do to try and make sure that offenders don't get to that level? There's a handful of key elements in every single probation violation that the court must look at. The risk level of the offender, both in terms of recidivism and overall public safety, the nature of the current violation, how serious is it, what are the factors that went into it, the response to previous violation interventions and the overall adjustment to probation, and then probably the most important at that given time of the violation is what is the resource available to address the behavior going on. If we want to leave this person in the community, we have to make sure that, A, the community's safe, if we're going to leave them there, and, B, that whatever led up to that violation, we can effectively address. Otherwise, there's really no net gain to leave that person in the community. Keep in mind that the presiding judge in a felony probation case is the one that makes the determination of whether the offender goes to prison or not. It is not the probation agent. It's the judge. The judge takes recommendations from the probation agent, but also equally from the prosecuting attorney and from the defense attorney. So we're just a piece of that puzzle. If a felony probationer is found in violation, the court must, under Minnesota Supreme Court guidelines, apply a set of standards. They're known as the Austin factors. The court cannot just arbitrarily say, you were placed on probation, you messed up one time, boom, I'm sending you to prison. In terms of the public, that is a frustrating factor to them because I think repeatedly we hear, well, folks were given a chance on probation and they blew it and they ought to just go to prison. You can't do that in Minnesota. There's a set of standards in place. The Supreme Court has also said in the Austin factors that the court cannot just make a reflexive reaction to accumulation of technical violations. The response to send someone to prison has to be because the offender's behavior has demonstrated that they cannot be counted on to avoid antisocial behavior. It can't just be a knee-jerk, boom, you're done, you didn't come to an appointment, you're going to prison. In addition to these standards, every probation department in Minnesota requires that every single felony violation report that an agent files gets supervisor approval. And finally, a number of counties have developed what you were asking about, Representative Hillstrom, formal sanctions guidelines. So they look at these factors, they look at like violation scenarios, like criminal histories, like circumstances, and come up with a guidelines grid of what the appropriate response is. Just about every probation department has done that, either on an informal or formal level. Certainly the bigger metro counties have formal grids because they're such large organizations that they need to make sure that cases are dealt with in a similar fashion. The other thing I wanted to mention is that virtually all MACAC counties, and I think most of the court services and DOC as well counties, are allowed through statute to hold what's called a sanctions conference with an offender. And so if an offender violates and it's something that we can deal with in the field informally with the offender and he agrees, we can apply a sanction. Oftentimes it's not a sanction as much as it is an intervention. So if the person is in outpatient treatment, they violate, they get kicked out, they're willing to go to inpatient, we can restructure them, have it approved by the court, but they don't ever make a court appearance. There's no jail sanction. There's no prison over their head. It's simply attempting to intervene to get them the level of service they need to manage them in the community rather than sending them to prison. Over on the Department of Corrections side with supervised release, I'm just going to touch on briefly, but as Tim said, we supervise those offenders, but the decisions to revoke, the guidelines to revoke, are all 100% the Department of Corrections hearings and release. They have developed a formal grid. It is pretty laid out as far as the severity level of the offense, what the offender violated in terms of conditions, and the presumptive amount of time that sanction an offender is going to get, whether it's remain in the community or be returned to prison. That is the same all over the state. Whether you're Scott County supervised releasee, Chippewa County, Cochin County, that grid applies all over the state. And that's what the Department of Corrections uses to make sure that all supervised releasees in Minnesota are treated with the same standards. They take the same things into effect that we do over on felony probation. But again, probably the most critical factor in that is if you're the hearing officer attempting to determine what you're going to do with this offender, what is available in the community for me to successfully maintain public safety and to intervene? Resources, I've mentioned that several times, and that's what I want to finish up with just briefly. We don't have a lot of time. But the success of an offender remaining in the community if they're given felony probation is 100% dependent on the ability to safely manage public safety right now and our ability to reduce the risk that public safety will be an issue in the future. We want to reduce that risk while we're managing them. Clearly, in order for those interventions to work, they have to be developed, they have to be available, and they have to be delivered in the community where the offender lives. You can't design a program that's going to work in St. Paul and think that it's going to work for offenders in Lac La Crosse County, for instance. They have different, they come from different backgrounds at times. There's different things that we have to deal with, transportation, et cetera. And we need to take those things into account. So in plain language, in order to work for offenders in my area, my programs and my interventions have to be tailored to the unique characteristics of my area, my offenders, and their needs. The Minnesota Office of Management and Budget just released their results first on adult corrections report. I know Commissioner Roy touched on that when they gave their presentation last week. It tells us for the first time exactly what works, what best practices work to effectively reduce recidivism, to manage offenders, and it tells you as funders what's the best benefit-to-cost ratio for those specific services. However, at the community level, we just can't achieve those outcomes that you as a state want, that we all want, if we don't have the resources to implement those effective interventions. The very services and programs that reduce recidivism the most, with the most benefit for your taxpayer dollars compared to cost, sex offender programming in the community, cognitive skills programming, supervising offenders based on the risk, need, responsibility principle of best practices. Those things, to put it bluntly, are very scarcely deliverable in the state with the resources we have right now. We are doing the best we can, but the need, the number of offenders that are medium and high risk and need those services far outpaces the resource we have to supervise them. One of the ways that every single jurisdiction deals with that, the risk tool that Tim mentioned, the cutoff levels for who is determined to be a medium risk or high risk offender based on the evidentiary actuarially assessment use of that tool. We have so many offenders that qualify in those areas that we have to move the cutoff tool for supervision far above what is acceptable. But we don't have a choice. We have to triage our offenders. We only have so much space available on a caseload, and we only have so much space available in a COG skills group. So we're triaging, and only the very highest risk folks right now are getting those types of services because we just don't have the resource. The other problem we have is that in rural areas of Minnesota, those resources aren't even available. COG skills group, sex offender treatment. In my area for outpatient, we have offenders that have to drive close to 2 hours one way weekly to get to outpatient sex offender treatment and then drive back that same distance. So it's just not available in some areas. In finishing, the other thing I just wanted to touch base from a Community Corrections Act perspective is that the services that are available, the best practices that are available to this point, have for the most part been delivered by counties through the local tax levy. We've gotten very little increase from the state over the course of the last 15 years or so to supplement what we're learning about best practices. So counties have borne that under their own budget to fund those resources. So if the state wants the outcomes that are outlined in the results first report and we want lower recidivism and less commitment to prison, we need to make sure that those resources that achieve those outcomes are available at the local county level. And the only way you can do that is to allocate resources for those interventions and make sure they get to us at the county level where we're doing that work. That's all I want you to know. I really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you about this topic. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming in. I ran about 5 minutes later than I would have liked, but there's a lot of good information, a lot of input from the committee, and I appreciate the work that you do. A lot of people don't see what the probation and corrections officers do, but that it is a lot of work, and I appreciate the work you do. And with that, this meeting will be adjourned.
Thank you.